I think that, you know, as you look at prophecy and you think about last Friday, to me, it was a significant waypoint along the way to the return of Jesus Christ. And I think Liz and I were talking about it today, and you've got not only that decision that was made in our country, but you also have the ISIS killing a vast number of people. They really went at it very hard that last Friday, and it makes you wonder, well, have we moved beyond a certain point of no return? Time will tell. But Christ gave us warning. He told us that he warns us of increased deception and false messiahs. Are those on the horizon? I would say probably you've always had them, but that's something that we should be aware of. He also cautions us about what we might call false returns. Now, I've never seen anybody proclaim a return of Christ. I know that they did back in the 19th century, and unfortunately a lot of people responded to that, and we've not seen anything quite that significant take place as far as a false return. But Christ warns us about false returns. And we may not have seen this personally, but the fact that Jesus warns us probably tells us maybe we should pay attention to that. So amidst the other signs in the prophecy that Christ gave on the Mount of Olives, where he talked about the end of the age, there's a particularly obscure statement that he made in Matthew chapter 24, beginning in verse 26. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 24 and look at verse 26. Matthew chapter 24, verse 26. In this, it begins in verse 26, "Therefore, if they say to you, 'Look, he is in the desert,' do not go out. Or, 'Look, he is in the inner rooms,' do not believe it." So if somebody proclaims to you that Christ has returned and he's in a particular location, he's saying don't believe it unless there are certain clear signs that have been revealed. You can see them and you can know that they're speaking authentically. He says, "For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man." Most of us, when it lightnings, we know that it's lightning, that lightning has shown itself, especially if it's dark, you can see it. It clearly flashes across the sky. It's obvious to everyone what's taking place. And he's saying, my return's going to be similar. It's not going to be something hidden, as we'll see. And then he says in verse 28, "For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together." For where the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. The Amplified Bible renders the verse, "Wherever there is a fallen body, a corpse, there the vultures or eagles will flock together." The birds described here belong to a family called Old World Vultures, a grouping which includes eagles, buzzards, kites, and hawks. And when vultures gathered to eat a carcass, it's called a wake. It's called a wake. And apparently we had a wake out here on the lawn. If you came here and noticed all the buzzards or whatever they happen to be out there, somebody said, "Did you plan your sermon accordingly?" I said, "No, I had no idea they were going to show up," but it does illustrate the point. So there must be something that they're enjoying out there on the lawn. So anyway, as you look at these birds, vultures very seldom attack healthy animals. But they have a keen sense for when one is wounded or sick. And so if that animal is wounded or sick, then they will attack that animal and seek to finish it off a little bit earlier in order that they can enjoy its flesh. Their digestive systems are so acidic that they can ingest rabies, cholera, botulinum toxin, and even deadly anthrax. Doesn't hurt them. So they're pretty potent birds, and they can eat things that none of us would dare eat and do just fine. They perform a purpose in the environment where they help to clean up things and keep down the spread of disease. So God made them to do that particular function. I know there was one with a broken wing that was close to our house, and so every time that I would take my dog out to walk around, then he would see that that buzzard, and so he would chase it, and it would sort of try to fly, and he never would attack it, but he loved chasing it. So anyway, it would get away and move to a place where he couldn't get it. And it was around for quite a while. I don't know what happened to it. Maybe he's here at the church hall today. As Christ says, where a carcass is, a wake of vultures is imminent. And this tells us little aside from the fact that it is a response to his disciples' question. What will be the sign of Christ coming and the end of the age? It's part of that, those signs of Christ coming and the end of the age. And combined with the reference to lightning, it implies that his return is going to be highly visible. We're all going to be able to see it. So let's go back to Matthew chapter 24 and look at verse 36. So just a little further on in the chapter, Matthew 24, verse 36. It says, beginning in verse 36, "But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will this coming of the Son of Man be. Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and the other left. Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." So this particular passage provides another concrete description of the circumstances surrounding the return of Jesus Christ. It emphasizes that his return will be at an unexpected hour. People are not going to be expecting it. It's going to come as a surprise for them. So we can tie this to his warnings about becoming caught in the cares of the world, so that the end time events commence when we are spiritually unprepared. And Christ makes this point a number of different times in the Gospels. If you go over one chapter to Matthew chapter 25, verse 13, it says in verse 13, "Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming." You know he's coming, but we don't know the day or the hour. He says in, let's go to Mark chapter 13. You might keep your finger in Matthew chapter 24. And in Mark chapter 13, let's look at verses 35 through 37. Verse 35. It says, "Watch therefore, for you do not know when the master of the house is coming." So we are to watch. We are to pay attention to what's going on in the world around us. Because by paying attention to what's going on, then we can know where we're at in time. We can have some inkling of whether things are unfolding and that Christ is going to be coming back. So he said to watch therefore, for we don't know exactly when that's going to be. It could be in the evening, at midnight, at the crowing of the rooster, or in the morning. Lest coming suddenly he find you sleeping. And what I say to you, I say to all, watch. So we are to watch the signs of the times and to be aware of what's unfolding before us. And as we see various things taking place, we can see that the conditions of the world are changing. They're not remaining, they're not stable. Our world is a very uncertain world, and many things are changing, and we must be aware of it. If we go back to Matthew 24, in light of all of this, we come to Matthew 24, verse 40. Matthew chapter 24, verse 40. So it adds another element to this particular matter of Christ's return and the signs of his coming. And it says in verse 40, "Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left." Verse 41, "Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and the other left." And so there are these, it describes these two individuals, two men, two women, one, the men in the field and the women grinding at the meal. In each case, one is taken and one is left. And as you, these particular verses are used by those who believe in the rapture, and they use these verses to support where there's going to be the secret rapture, and one individual will be taken up to heaven, and the other will remain on the earth. And that's not what he's talking about there. We, you know, as we think about what we've read so far, we need to keep in mind that the only thing that's secret about Christ's return is what? The only thing that's secret about Christ's return is his timing. When he returns, everybody's going to know it. It's going to be announced by seven trumpets. It's going to be announced by seven trumpets, and when the seventh trump sounds, he's going to appear in the clouds, and people are going to be able to see him. So everybody's going to hear these trumpets. They may not know what they represent, but they're going to hear them. And then you're going to see Christ in the clouds, and it's going to be as bright as a flash of lightning. So the event will be visible to all, and those who advocate the rapture assume that taken here means that they're going to be taken up to heaven to be with Christ. However, in all of the 49 books of the New Testament, the usage of the particular word there about, which is paralambano, nowhere does it give the idea of being taken up into heaven. The only verse that even approaches that meaning is found in John chapter 14, verse 3. John chapter 14, verse 3. So does John chapter 14, verse 3 support this particular idea? Does it support the idea of being snatched up to heaven in a secret rapture? John 14, verse 3 says, "And if I go, that is, if I die and I am raised from the grave and I return to my Father, if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also." So does this support being taken up into heaven? As you look at it, it really doesn't. The verse doesn't actually support that idea of being taken off to heaven. It says that he's going to return, and where he is, you will be there as well. And where is he going to set up his kingdom? He's going to set it up on earth. And he's telling his disciples that they can be there with him as that kingdom is established. Also, Matthew 24, verses 40 and 41 speaks of a divine distinction between peoples in the future. Some will be received near to Christ and associated with him in a familiar or intimate way. And the word can even imply they assume an office that is spoken of there. So those under judgment, however, will be left and not allowed to accompany Christ. This being left, you know, as you look at one individual who's taken up, they rise to meet Christ in the air, and the other one's left there, I would say that that's probably a bad sign if you're left. You're not wanting to be left. And the being left may be what happens to the foolish virgins who are left outside the wedding feast. You know, if Christ returns and the wedding feast is taking place and you're not able, you know that that's to take place, but you know that you cannot attend, that's going to be a pretty dire situation to be in, if that is how it plays out. To the sons of the kingdom who will be cast out into outer darkness instead of entering the kingdom, it speaks about in Matthew chapter 8, verses 11 and 12. It also might, to others who are found to be unworthy to enter the kingdom. And they're mentioned in several different places throughout the scriptures. In Matthew 24, verses 48 through 51 and other locations. So somebody being taken and the other one being left behind, there is a distinction being made between those two individuals. And Christ is using it to illustrate that there will be this distinction. And I think we all want to be a part of those who will rise to meet Christ in the air. We want to be the one taken and not the one left behind. Let's look at what Luke has to say about this subject. In Luke's account, the same description found in Matthew chapter 24, that description is very similar. And that description links with the eagles being gathered together. showing that they are part of the same context. So let's go to Luke chapter 17 and look at verse 22. Luke chapter 17, verse 22. Verse 22 begins and says, "Then he said to the disciples, 'The days will come when you will desire to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it. And they will say to you, "Look here," or "Look there." Do not go after them or follow them." So if people tell you that Christ has returned, then you need to be dubious, because it will be obvious that he's returned, as you'll see by the end of the sermon. So if people tell you to look here or there, do not go after them or follow them. Verse 24, "For as the lightning that flashes out of one part under heaven shines to the other part under heaven, so also the Son of Man will be in his day." So it's lightning is obvious. Christ's return will be obvious. "But first he must suffer many things and be rejected by this generation. And as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be also in the days of the Son of Man." So we see that he's describing similar things, a little bit different wording, which hopefully helps us to better clarify things. So he's giving us, again, a general warning against being deceived by a false return. But the prophecies are clear that when he returns, it's going to be unmistakable. There's going to be no doubt. Let's go to verse 26, chapter 17, verse 26. "Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot, they ate and they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built." So life went on as normal. "But on the day that Lot went in out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even so will it be in the day where the Son of Man is revealed. In that day he who is on the housetop and his goods are in the house, let him not come down to take them away. And likewise the one who is in the field, let him not turn back." Don't turn back, it says. "Remember Lot's wife. Whoever seeks to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it. I tell you, in that night there will be two men in one bed. The one will be taken and the other will be left." And he goes on and describes one person being taken and the other left. So Jesus focuses on Lot and he focuses on Noah to warn that even though life seems to be relatively normal, when God brings judgment, it will be sudden and complete. Because God is just. There will be indicators and warnings if we're willing to look for them and see them. But when he decides that the time is ripe for him to intervene, it will happen with breathtaking speed. And it's telling us that if this begins to unfold, it's not time to pack up. It's not time to go back in and get whatever you consider to be valuable. We're warned to flee and not to linger or look back, as did Lot's wife. Just like he told Lot and his family to get out of Sodom, that's what we're going to be told. There will come a point you need to leave now. And there's going to be no doubt about the timing. And so we need to be of a mind that if that's what God requires of us, we can take quick action. Let's go to chapter 17 and down to verse 34. Chapter 17, verse 34. "I tell you, in that night there will be two men in one bed. The one will be taken and the other will be left. Two women will be grinding together. The one will be taken and the other left. Two men will be in the field. The one will be taken and the other left." And they answered and said to him, "Where, Lord?" So he said to them, "Wherever the body is, there the eagles will be gathered together." Where, Lord, is the question they ask when they heard what Christ was describing here. And the question that they're asking appears to be about where all of this would be taking place. Where is all of this going to be taking place, including his return, which would initiate the judgment, rather than about where his followers would be taken? They're asking, where is all this going to unfold? We might recall that in Matthew's account, their original question was about the sign of Christ coming and the end of the age. So what appears to have been on their minds were the specifics of his return rather than the location of those taken. That's not the focus of the question. The question is, where is all of this going to take place? Not where they're taken to. So how does Christ answer? He gives them a direct statement exactly where this is going to take place. He doesn't do that. As Christ usually does, he doesn't answer their question directly. Instead, his answer applies on multiple levels. And instead of, in the two accounts, the disciples ask when and where, since we humans want to know a specific date and location so we can gauge how things are going, but he doesn't give them that. Instead, he gives them principles. He gives them principles by which we can make a judgment. So let's consider two ways to understand Christ's answer here. Let's look at two ways that we can understand what he said. The first explanation is that a wake of vultures is an indicator of God's judgment for rebellion. That wake of vultures is an indicator of God's judgment for rebellion. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 28, verse 26. Deuteronomy 28. And Deuteronomy 28 is a place where it speaks of judgment upon the house of Israel. And verse 26, it says, "Your carcasses shall be food for all the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth, and no one shall frighten them away." It's speaking about the punishment upon Israel and that they would suffer in various ways. They would die and they would be, and as a result of their carcasses being lying around, then the carrion birds would show up and the beast of the earth, and no one shall frighten them away. They're going to come and they're going to devour the dead bodies. So we see this as one of the, this is would be a curse. But we realize, and God is telling some Israel that if they sin against him and do not conform to his ways, then there will be a consequence. It's a judgment of great shame, one that has been fulfilled in type. When you go into Israel's history and you look at the fall of the nation, the fall of the city of Jerusalem, and the destruction of the temple, that's talked about in Psalm 79. Let's go to Psalm 79. Psalm 79, and let's look at verses 1 through 3. Psalm 79, verses 1 through 3. Verse 1 says, "O God, the nations have come into your inheritance. Your holy temple they have defiled. They have laid Jerusalem in heaps. The dead bodies of your servants they have given as food for the birds of the heavens, the flesh of your saints to the beast of the earth. Their blood they have shed like water all around Jerusalem, and there is no one to bury them." So they're just lying around there. There is no burial. And the beasts are devouring them. The carrion birds are devouring them, as is their nature. So under this curse, the Israelites would have no dignity in their deaths. They would have to have no one to bury them. And what's described here is utter defeat and disgrace and personal insignificance when no defenders are left to keep the scavengers from tearing a human body apart just as they would a dead animal. So when God cleans his creation in this way, a person becomes nothing more than a meal for one of the most despised creatures. Now, that doesn't mean that God doesn't care. It just means that God is going to, at that particular point, for those individuals, he's going to deal with them in that way. And we all know that there is the resurrection of the dead to come. But the Israelites are not the only ones to receive such judgment. Let's go to Revelation chapter 19. We see some of these things unfolding at the end of the age. Revelation chapter 19, verses 17 through 19. Revelation chapter 19, verse 17. Then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried with a loud voice, saying to all the birds that fly in the midst of heaven, come and gather together for the supper of the great God, that you may eat the flesh of kings, the flesh of captains, the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses, and of those who sit on them, and the flesh of all people, free and slave, both small and great. And I saw the beasts, the kings of the earth, and their armies gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. So they're going to fight against Jesus Christ. And God tells us that those armies are going to be destroyed, and they're going to provide a great supper for all of the vultures and the buzzards and the different birds that will be gathered there to the dead bodies. Verse 21, it says, and the rest were killed with the sword which proceeded from the mouth of him who sat on the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh. Now, these aren't just figurative things. They're things that are going to actually take place in reality. They're very disturbing in one sense, but this is how it's going to play out as God fulfills his great plan and establishes the throne of Jesus Christ on Mount Zion. Let's go to Ezekiel chapter 39. Ezekiel chapter 39. And this is of another rebellion that is to take place against God, and they're going to come up and seek to destroy the cities that are established in the promised land, cities without walls. They're going to see the people of God prospering. They don't need walls. Things are peaceful there. They're prosperous. But these individuals are going to see, hey, we can easily take these cities and take all of their wealth and gather it for ourselves. But they forget that God is there, and God is overseeing the people of Israel and protecting these people. But they're going to think, well, these will be easy pickings. Let's begin in verse 17. It says in verse 17, As for you, son of man, thus says the Lord God, speak to every sort of bird and to every beast of the field. Assemble yourselves and come gather together from all sides to my sacrificial meal, which I am sacrificing for you, a great sacrificial meal on the mountains of Israel, that you may eat flesh and drink blood. You shall eat the flesh of the mighty, drink the blood of the princes of the earth, of rams and lambs, of goats and bulls, all of them fatlings of Bashan. You shall eat fat till you are full, and drink blood till you are drunk at my sacrificial meal, which I am sacrificing for you. You shall be filled at my table with horses and riders, with mighty men, and with all the men of war, says the Lord God. And so God is going to put down all the rebellion and these great armies that will be gathered to fight against Jesus Christ at his return. The followers of the beast and false prophet will be killed, and God will specifically call the carrion birds for this gruesome feast. That's something that is to unfold at the end of the age. So that gives us some idea of one of the explanations of what it's talking about when it talks about this gathering of eagles or gathering of vultures. And there's still another way to understand Christ's answer about the wake of vultures, something we can see happening right now. So there's a different way to look at this. A gathering of vultures indicates a diseased spiritual condition. It indicates a diseased spiritual condition. Let's go back to Revelation and look at chapter 18. Revelation chapter 18. Let's look at verse 2. Revelation chapter 18, verse 2. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen. And has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. Speaking of Babylon as a haven for those things that are unclean. Vultures are undoubtedly at the top of the list of unclean and hated birds. In time, Babylon is the focal point of demonic spirits, which are likened to unclean birds. Both of them prey on the sick and injured, and they gather where death is. And this is where it becomes relevant to all of us. Our greatest threat is not the tribulation at the end. Our greatest threat is not the tribulation. As bad as it will be, far worse is being spiritually unprepared when Christ returns and being judged as unworthy to enter the kingdom. All that the tribulation is going to do is bring about a time of persecution on the people of God. Now, that's not going to be any fun. But worse than that is for God to say, you didn't make the cut. You did not make it. You are not worthy to enter the kingdom. That's what the parable of the 10 virgins and the parable of the wedding feast are all about. This is the substance of the warnings about Christ's return, being like a thief in the night, coming when he is completely unexpected. Coming when he's completely unexpected. And if he's telling us, I am going to come, you should expect my return, then he's giving us a warning. And he's been warning God's people for 2,000 years, ever since these words have been written down. To be awake, to be aware of what's going on around you. Don't take it lightly. But he's telling us this, and it's obvious from what he's saying, some people are going to be caught unawares. Some people are not going to expect the return of Jesus Christ. They're going on with life as it's always been. And he's saying, you have to be careful. We move on with life, but you've always got to keep in mind that this is ultimately going to be fulfilled. This is why he warns us against neglecting so great a salvation and being led away, led astray by the cares of the world. Being led away and astray by the deceitfulness of riches and the pleasures of life. And even though we can see the world declining around us, becoming immorality, becoming sanctioned and promoted, we can see these things taking place, we can still go on with life as usual. Our jobs, our children grow up, go to school, our children do all of these various things, and we do the various things that we've always done. It's very easy to just remain with that pattern and to not even think about what's coming. And I know for younger people, this is difficult because as younger people, you don't want to hear it. You expect everything's going to keep going on. And it may. But there is coming a time when it will all come to an end. I know that, we've been in the church for 40-some years, and we thought Christ was coming a long time ago. We didn't believe that our children would ever grow up. But they did. So they're grown, and they're, they've got children of their own. My daughter has children, but we're all going on with life. But you can't, just because life goes on and everything seems like it's normal, you cannot neglect to take to heart what he's telling us here. Jesus warns us to keep us on the path of life so we don't fall to the birds of prey that stalk the spiritually dying. And you might not have thought of demons in that particular way as beings that are stalking you. You know, they're overhead and buzzing around, as do the buzzards and vultures, and they're hoping that you will die and they will have a nice meal. We're given the charge to come out of Babylon. We're to come out of Babylon, so we do not share in her sins or in her judgment. So we've taken some serious steps toward Babylon being more fully established, and we do not want to conform to those things. And I think that we're going to be challenged greatly ahead in what we believe and why we believe it. So if we have a discerning heart, we should have a good idea of what will attract the vultures, as we'll be giving off the smell of spiritual death. And God gives us the discerning heart so we can make good choices. We want to make good choices about what we do and why we do it, and we want to do those things that are pleasing to God. So we've read the scriptures about the swiftness of Christ's return. The question we have to ask is, do we really believe them? Do you think that Christ is, when it starts, he's going to come quickly? Do we really believe what the scriptures are telling us? And are we responding to those scriptures and living by them? As we look at world events, and we can compare them to our understanding of prophecy, we understand that things are bad and getting worse. But the end still seems to be just over the horizon. How long? How many years is it going to be? I can't say. And I don't think any of us can say. Because it's not here yet, it's easy to conclude, even subconsciously, that there's no need to become serious just yet. That's a ways off. He just told us the story that 40 years ago they thought Christ's return was imminent, and here he is. Here he is, he's 64. A lot of years have passed by and nothing's happened really. But that conclusion is a dangerous conclusion. Because it's a conclusion, you know, we can say, well, it's a ways off, we don't have to worry about it. But let's look at, that conclusion is filled with certain assumptions. And the first one of those assumptions is this, that our understanding of end time events is correct. It's a ways off. It's not happening yet. Are you sure? Look at Matthew 1, and don't have to turn there. I'm telling you to read this at some point in time. Look at Matthew 1 and compare what takes place there in light of the decision made on June 26th. That's a pretty dramatic decision, and it's telling you that that's a pretty dramatic decision, and there are serious consequences to that and all of the other sins that it documents there. A second assumption is that even if we do have correct understanding, we will never lose it through deception. If you have a correct understanding, can you lose it through deception? Will we always hold fast to what we have come to believe and know to be true, or will we be deceived? See, only if you're spiritually healthy are you going to be able to discern the spirits and to be able to sort through things. And I know from personal experience when there were people that when the Trinity idea was preached, there were people that said, no way, I reject this out of hand, I don't believe this at all. However, I wasn't that smart. So what I did is I did my best to understand and believe it. I wouldn't today because of that experience. But I did my best to come to understand it and believe it, and I thought about it and chewed on it long enough that I don't remember the exact day, but I was outside mowing my lawn, and I'm mowing along and thinking about this, and I came to the conclusion, you know what? I know how to reconcile this and live with it. That thought went through my head, and then I said, hold on. What are you doing? And said, I'm not going down that path. And God is a merciful God, and if you're seeking Him and seeking to understand Him, He will lead you through any deceptions. You will be able to discern the spirits. You'll be able to see the right path to go. But that's contingent on your seeking God and drawing close to Him and humbling yourself before God. If you're oblivious to God, and you're basically saying, you know what? When I see, you know, the buildings on fire, then I'm going to take action. That may be too late. So he said, you need to think about this now and be prepared so you understand what you believe and why you believe it. And that way, when you hear something that you know to be incorrect, when somebody says, you know what? Christ is over here and you've not seen this bright coming, you're going to say, can't be happening. That cannot be happening. There's more to come and you're not going to be taken in. A third thing to consider here, a third assumption is this, is that our faith will remain constant until the end. Will it? will our faith remain constant unto the end? Now, it can, but that's going to take some time and some effort and really focusing upon what we believe in and why we believe it. A fourth assumption is this, is that when we do decide to get serious, that we will have ample time to build character, take on the image of God, and complete our developing as God's people. Do we have the time? Do we have the time? How much time do we need? I worry about, you know, I've been at it for so many years, but I've not attained. I can't say that I've attained. There's still work to be done. The question is, am I willing to put the time and the effort in yielding to God and seeking God that that work can be completed? That's up to each one of us. That's up to each one of us. And, you know, you cannot get, you know, when you're in the midst of it, you aren't going to get it together. For instance, they have the individual called the weekend warrior. All right. Probably all of us have been weekend warriors. I try to be a weekend warrior, but I'm just a weak warrior at this point. I don't get much done. You know, you have a certain capacity as a physical human being, and I'm going on at my age on all of the skills and physical strength that I gained in my 20s and 30s. I've tried to maintain it a little bit, but it's woefully lacking at this point. I figured that out quite quickly when we went paddle boarding. So we went paddle boarding at camp, and it was not a pretty sight. So paddle boarding is fun. It's kind of a serene experience as you paddle around the lake. It's not meant to be intense, but it's just enjoying your surroundings. So I'm enjoying my surroundings. However, I'm so out of it physically that I can't stand on the board for very long. It takes some physical strength. So I feel my legs starting to shake, and I feel like I'm going to go over, and I did. And then the real discouraging part was trying to get back on the board. You have to have upper body strength to pull yourself back up on the board. Sorry, that was lacking. So, but it just tells you that if you're going to go do something, and we're talking about physically strenuous, if you just go out there and try to do it, in all likelihood, you're not going to be able to do it. You've got to be in a physical condition to do it. So spiritually speaking, when you face possibly the most intense time that we've ever faced in our lives, and you're challenged, you aren't going to get in shape during the experience. You're going to have to be in shape before. And getting in shape spiritually means all of us have to put in the time and the effort and be close to God. And God is close to us, and He will strengthen us through whatever we go through. But we've got to put the time and effort into it. We can't wait until the crisis hits. A fifth assumption is this, is that our Creator will go along with our agenda of pushing off until the last minute. That may not be the case. Those are a lot of assumptions. So if we are misjudging these things, we may hear Christ's words, which He mentioned in the Sermon on the Mount. We may hear the terrible words that He says in Matthew 7, verse 23. I never knew you. There are no worse words we can hear. I never knew you. Depart from me. And that never has to be said, but there are no worse words that we can hear. If we're delaying the time to start seeking God, the vultures may be eyeing us as ones who may not spiritually survive what lies ahead. Perhaps all of us have been seeing this happen to people we care about. And if we're spiritually sick or injured, there is no time like the present to seek our healer and protector to beat off the hated birds. In the parable of the 10 virgins, the foolish ones thought they had more time. They thought they had more time. They were probably aware that their reserve of oil was not as full as it should be. But they may have assumed that they could always attend to that later. They did not count on falling asleep, and they didn't count on life happening, and that something would prohibit them from taking care of preparations they had put off. A lesson that we can draw from this is this. If we're not putting everything we have into our calling right now, how much time is left doesn't matter. If that's the case, we may find ourselves like the foolish virgin, suddenly awake, realizing we cannot get ready in time. And what we claimed we wanted will have slipped through our grasp one day at a time. I'll take care of it tomorrow. I'm really going to get on an intense course of study and preparation, but I'm going to start next week. And then it's the week after. And the thing is, time eventually runs out. Judgment is coming on the world, but it's on the house of God now. A gathering of eagles, a wake of vultures is the symbol of God's judgment on those who stubbornly resist coming into alignment with Him. And vultures will literally gather for those who rebel against God in the final battle. And the vultures are metaphorically already circling those who cannot tear themselves away from Babylon. So the multitude of warnings and prophecies means that it is a possibility for us, because it is a certainty for some. Yet with all that God makes available, there is no good reason for that judgment to fall on us. So I hope you better understand Christ's statement in Matthew 24 about a gathering of eagles.